Committee to order. This is the House Committee on Judiciary Subcommittee on Corrections and Criminal Law, and we have members in other meetings. I want to go ahead and proceed with a hearing portion of this.
Would you like to see that?
Committee, we do have one item on for work session, and I'll take that as the second item. Senator Yee is here on Senate Bill 581. I believe you have someone to testify also. So if you come up, I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Senator May Yee from Senate District 19. I'm sure Senate Bill 581 looks familiar to you because this is a version of the repeal of the Riot Act that came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee for the first time during the 1985 session. Before I go any further, I want to introduce Dave Bianchi. I'm sure you know who he is, and he has joined me as a sponsor. Well, this bill is at the request of Mr. Hassel Herring and Jackson Frost and the American Civil Liberties Union. I have never done a bill at the request of American Civil Liberty Union before. This is the first time. But Senate Bill 581, as I mentioned before, is a version of a bill that came out of the 1985 Senate Judiciary Committee for the first time, and that bill completely repealed the entire Oregon riot statute and was vetoed by Governor Attia. He wanted to retain subsection 1 of the act in order to maintain the power of public officers to disperse a crowd in case of a riotous situation on private property. He stated that subsection 1 was necessary to give law enforcement officers the power to command dispersion whenever there was not time to contact property owners. Subsequently, the 1985 Deadly Force Act was amended to include a partial repeal of the Riot Act, reinstating subsection 1 that the governor had wanted to see remain. He then, however, vetoed the bill for other reasons which are not relevant to the issue of the Riot Act. So this is the third go at it, and we hope that the third time is a charm. Senate Bill 581 does not repeal the Oregon Riot Act, ORS 131-675, in total. The bill amends the law by eliminating subsection 2 and 3 of the statute section and also repeal ORS 131-990. Subsection 2 of the current Riot Act provides that when persons are unlawfully or riotously assembled, law enforcement officers may command the aid of private persons to disperse the crowd, and that no person can refuse such a command. This law was declared unconstitutional by the U.S. District Court in Oregon in 1986 as violative of the First, Fourth, and Fourteenth Amendments. The language in the statute was found to be vague and overbroad, incapable of setting any reasonably precise standard of guilt, and making it illegal, constitutionally protected activities. Furthermore, the law as it now stands subjects a public officer, the sheriff, or other public officers to criminal liability for failure to exercise the authority of the Riot Act, and this is simply against good public policy and is also unnecessary. We tried last session to repeal the archaic Riot Act. The time has come to get this unconstitutional law off the books, and I'm sure you agree, and I urge your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Senator. David, did you want to make a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is David Fidanke, Associate Director of the ACLU of Oregon. I have submitted some written testimony, which I won't read in light of the time factor. A couple of points I'd like to add to Senator Yee's testimony. The version of the bill which passed out of the Senate this year is identical to the version that was tacked on to the deadly force bill last session and was vetoed for other reasons. As opposed to last session, this proposal now has the endorsement of Linn County District Attorney Jack Frost, as well as the ACLU. The ACLU would have just as soon repealed the entire statute, but it is subsections 2 and 3, which are the onerous portions of it. In our view, subsection 1 was unnecessary, but there isn't any harm, we feel, in leaving it on the books. In just briefly explain to you how subsection 2 of the statute has been used in the recent past to create some mischief. It was used against some anti-logging demonstrators in Linn County who were bystanders at a civil disobedience demonstration. Two of them were freelance photographers. One, in fact, was employed by the Portland Alliance. They were called out of the crowd that was on the sidelines by a Linn County Sheriff's deputy in order to arrest the demonstrators who were blocking the road. When they were refused, pursuant to the statute, they were charged with Class C felonies, as was a third person who was called out of the crowd after saying to the deputies, "Are you only going to arrest members of the press today?" And that person was called out of the crowd and was ordered to arrest the demonstrators and also charged with a Class C felony. The charges were dropped one day before our cooperating attorneys were prepared to argue a motion to have the statute ruled unconstitutional. A civil suit was later filed, in which the ACLU was not directly involved, but I have given to committee staff a copy of Judge Levy's decision, which ruled that the statute, at least subsection 2 of the existing statute, is unconstitutional. I hope the committee will agree that this proposal is something that ought to sail through the House as it has sailed through the Senate already this session, and we're confident that Governor Goldschmidt will sign it.
Hey, thank you. Are there questions? Mr. Springer?
Do we know the date and the floor vote in the Senate?
It was unanimous.
Unanimous?
I remember it was unanimous, or close to unanimous.
Thank you.
I could check that.
We can check the calendar also. Thank you, Senator.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for being here and for your time, and I'm sorry we got started late, but thanks, David.
Thanks,
Senator. Anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 581? If not, I'll close the hearing on that bill. And I want to move to, jumping around a little bit, but I want to move to work session on House Bill 2844. This bill, if you recall, was before us in committee. You'll have a LC draft 2844-3. There was some concerns expressed about the original bill in the form that it was, and I put that aside from the committee at one point and asked the parole board to return to me with any potential amendments they may have. And Vern Fotz, I think, is here. If I could ask him to come up, the amendments we have proposed are his, and explain those to us. Essentially, it would the amendments would replace the bill as it's printed. So, Fotz.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Vern Fotz. I'm the chairman of the State Oregon State Board of Parole. The Board of Parole is required to set a sentence on a prisoner within 6 months of his incarceration at a state institution. This amendment, and I think it's a fairly straightforward amendment, would give us a little latitude in that it would allow us to set persons who are imprisoned for life or for more than 15 years sometime within the first year rather than within the first 6 months. And the reason for that is that our caseload is growing so rapidly that we're having difficulties in scheduling people within that first 6 months. We're now in the fifth month. I've been with the parole board now just not quite 4 weeks, and I'm trying to get a handle on the management of that operation and feel that we need these amendments in order to give us a little flexibility and a little latitude, some elbow room, so that we can make some decisions about how we're going to manage this workload before it eats us up.
Okay. Vern, there isn't anyone who gets parole in the first 6 months of their incarceration if they're in this kind of term?
Well, no. When you've got people who are there for 15 years to life, they're there on minimum terms exceeding a year, or they have matrix ranges that exceed a year in every instance.
Okay, are there questions of the committee? Good. The amendments that are there before us, if you look down on the dash three amendments, what we're talking here really about is in the section one of the bill. The rest of the information on page two and three remains as it is in current statute. Any questions on that? This is a work session, so chair entertain a motion.
Move the amendments, dash three.
Representative Springer moves the amendments to 2844, which are the dash three amendments, LC 980-2, to House Bill 2844. Any discussion? Any objection to the amendments? None. That's so ordered. Motion on the bill.
I move the bill as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves House Bill 2844 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the bill. Not. Clerk, call roll.
Bellman?
Aye.
Phillips?
No.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, if we haven't done so, I think we've got a couple members nose out of joint because we've gotten stuffed one of their bills without notice, and I think we ought to, as a courtesy to the sponsors on this, at least advise them of the action that's being considered.
I will do that. Okay, fine. Thank you, Mr. Watts. Appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's go back to the agenda. Senate Bill 111. Wayne Harris.
Can you say that again, please? What number?
Senate Bill 111.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Wayne Harris, District Court Judge in Yamhill County, and I'm the current chair of the Special Courts Committee. I'm here to urge the passage of Senate Bill 111. This bill provides judges with some tools that will be effective or helpful in dealing with driving under the influence diversion programs, particularly in some evidentiary questions. In Section 1, it provides, of course, that the certified driving record may be used in determining whether an applicant has a prior diversion somewhere else, and in effect allows us to use evidence that might not be admissible otherwise. The other important provision is contained in Section 9, and that allows or requires that there be a hearing before a diversion is revoked for any reason. This is appropriate, but it also provides that in the event the divertee fails to appear for that hearing, the diversion can be revoked at that point and or terminated, I guess is the words of the statute, and then maybe set aside, put in an inactive status, warrants issued, things of that sort. But allows the courts to terminate the diversion if the defendant fails to appear for that hearing. That in itself would be an act of violation of the diversion agreement for not complying with the court's order. And then finally, in the final section, Section 10, it excludes the evidence code from in the diversion hearings, either the allowance or termination hearings, and allows us to take evidence that might otherwise be excluded, such as the reports of alcohol counselors or anyone else who would provide written reports without perhaps their testimony being presented. So I would urge the passage of the bill.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions? Committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brad Swank.
Record. My name is Brad Swank. I'm here representing the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm trying to get the chair to move in the proper direction. I will speak very briefly, and I'll speak about the Judicial Department's support for three bills, 111, 177, 178, in order to save your time so you don't have to call me up on the other ones again.
What we might want to do, actually, and I'll ask Mr. Harris to come back up on, since those are related bills, to come back up on the other two when you finish, and we'll take it that way. And then I think you guys are here on the three bills also, so we'll try to do it, group them. Just make sure you tell me which bill you're talking about when you say something.
The Special Courts Committee was a committee that was put together in the Judicial Department to look at particular problems with some of the traffic laws and other laws that we have, and Judge Harris has done a good job of chairing that and bringing forth these problems. We think that these three bills, the Oregon Judicial Department thinks that these three bills help out with particular problems in areas of traffic law, and two of them in particular deal with diversion problems and problems in the diversion program. We think that they will help make diversion on DUI offenses work more the way the legislature originally intended it, without some of the hitches and some of the ways that bright young attorneys have found to get around recently. And it's been a good law. It's helped the courts save money. It's helped identify drunk drivers who previously were not identified without punishing them too much on their first offense if they didn't kill somebody or maim somebody or weren't previously convicted. In those senses, the two of them dealing with diversion are good, and the other one deals with a problem in suspension.
Which ones are we talking about here? I'm sorry.
That's okay. The one dealing with 177 and 111 both deal with problems with the diversion currently, and 178 deals with a problem that occurs in relation to the suspension of driving privileges for subsequent offenses. And the department is supportive of all of them, and I'm sure that Judge Harris can answer any specific questions you have about the bill. They went through Senate Judiciary with amendments to clarify two of them, and I'll be here if you have any questions on them, too.
Okay, but the Judicial Department is supportive of all three bills.
Supportive of all three bills. They came out of a committee that was formed in the Judicial Department to resolve these kinds of problems.
What the Senate vote was on these bills?
Excuse me?
What the Senate vote was on these bills?
No, I don't know what the Senate vote was.
29-0.
29-0 on which ones? We'll check
Senate,
that
Senate
out.
Bill 111-29-0. Senate Bill 177-29-0. Senate Bill 178-27-0.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Swank. Appreciate that. You want to come back? Actually, are you guys all on the same side here? Why don't you all come up? We'll deal with... Is that all right?
Yeah, the briefer, the better.
So let's go... you've already spoken to 111. You want to speak to 111?
For the record, my name is Jane with the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm here to testify or indicate support for the Governor's Advisory Committee for all three bills. And with that, I can indicate that at least as to 177, 178, the endorsement vote of the committee was unanimous. 111, we had, there are some provisions of the original bill that we preferred, but the bill in its present form is completely accepted from the Governor's Advisory Committee. So we'd urge a due pass on all three of the bills.
Okay. Good. Judge Harrison, 177, 178.
All right, on Senate Bill 177, this would solve a problem that has arisen in the defense of driving under the influence cases, that is, seeking to have a trial, and then if you're still within the 30 days after the original arraignment, filing an application for diversion. some courts are that fast and they could be doing that. Or they're requesting an early or a trial within 30 days, filing their diversion following that. This bill would prevent a individual from either entering a plea of guilty, no contest, or going to trial and then coming back later to filing for the diversion. I don't think that fits the original intent of the diversion program nor the judges. So we would urge that be passed. Did you want me to go ahead with 178 or?
Yes, please.
Okay. Senate Bill 178 relates to a problem that arises in suspensions of driver's licenses, and the language that is changed would be that the suspension deals with a lapse of 5 years from the last conviction to the next conviction, present law. This would change that from the last conviction to the present offense, so that you would not have the games playing of delaying trial, so finally it's been tried and convicted. It's now outside the 5-year period and make a 1-year suspension rather than a 3-year suspension, or 90 days rather than by using triggering date as the second offense rather than the second conviction to avoid that.
I've got a quick question on 111, if I might pose that to the judge. It's my understanding that, and correct me on this, but it's been a while since I've been in court, that the district attorneys generally are required to try to produce an abstract of the driving record of the prior conviction in order to disqualify an individual, and that one of the purposes of presenting that abstract of the conviction from whatever records are maintained may be to try to establish, based upon that record, whether or not the person was represented by counsel. And that, in fact, I believe subsequent to an appellate court ruling, if the record fails to disclose that that individual was represented by counsel and may have been an uncounseled guilty plea or conviction for whatever purpose, that the court may not consider that conviction for purposes of disqualification to participate in the diversion program. How would the language in 111 affect that sort of sequence of events or that responsibility or availability of information as to whether or not the prior conviction was, in fact, rendered with or without the assistance of counsel?
I'm not sure that that's the burden of the prosecutor to present evidence concerning whether there is a unconstitutional prior conviction that is one that either could be set aside by post-conviction relief or that a Standifer-type hearing could be held wherein you take evidence at the diversion approval hearing, find out if it was, in fact, an unconstitutionally obtained conviction. I think the defendant has to at least make the presentation. I was convicted before, and I didn't know what I was doing, and it's all a mistake. I shouldn't have been convicted. I don't think the state has that burden, and so I don't believe that this changes the burden of proof. And the state still may show whether it's a certified copy of a driving record or an abstract of the conviction. The person has a prior conviction. If the person then denies that or indicates that it was not a valid conviction.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The chair asked me to announce that he'd be taking about a 1-minute recess.
Okay, thank you. We'll close the hearings on those.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make one comment. It's a law school classmate of mine who is responsible for the law that was created in 177. But putting that aside, I appreciate the judge's comment about games playing. I guess as a person who's prosecuted a lot more DUIs than I've defended, but who has defended some, as I'm sure the judge is aware, it's the responsibility of every attorney to represent his client or her client to the best of his or her ability. And I guess it's a matter of interpretation as to whether or not that's games playing. I would suggest that any attorney exercising that duty who sought to protect the interests of his or her client under existing statutes was doing the best to protect his or her client's interests, not playing games.
Okay, let's go to Senate Bill 114. And Oh, I'm sorry, yes. You're here on 216?
Yes.
I think it's the one I just called once. Let's hear on Senate Bill 216. Representative Kopetsky? Whomever. Did you say opponent or proponent?
Proponent.
Are you on the same side? We can sit down together then.
Yeah.
This would be Senate Bill 216.
Yeah.
Why don't you...
Clock's running, Kopetsky. Hey, Mike. No. Clock's running.
Well, Mr. Nestle is going to present his... brings you Senate Bill 216. I have a little amendment for Senate Bill 216, Mr. Chair, and...
Do we have it?
You will.
Thank you.
Now, I have to... for the record, my name is Mike Kopetsky, State Representative, District 33. Last session, I had the pleasure of serving on the Judiciary Committee, and we got into the... whole area of risk management and reimbursement of agencies when people are sued. Judges, for example, get sued in different proceedings, and the issue is who pays the bill? We have what's called our risk management fund, which is in essence our insurance company for the state, and that is one big pot of money from which these types of bills could be paid. Another pot of money would be an individual agency's budget, by which the agency itself would directly pay the costs of any litigation. And we had this round and round debate in Judiciary Committee, and it was knocked down, drag out, and then it was one of those things where you roll out the door and you go down the hall and down the stairs and end up in Ways and Means. And I thought I had one understanding of the bill we passed last session, and but wouldn't you know it, we didn't really nail down the policy in one area of this issue, and it's, it has to do with who's going to pay for the litigation expenses and mandamus proceedings brought against a state employee called judge. Well, my argument during Judiciary and down in Ways and Means was that if whatever isn't for this purpose, whatever isn't a contract is a tort, and risk management pays the torts, and therefore you pay the bill. Well, poor Mr. Nestle here has had the opportunity over the interim to spend, devote a margin of his life researching the law on this issue, and I didn't know. I knew that a attorney general's opinion would be was pending and would be coming any moment for the past year. And wouldn't you know it, yesterday or the day before, this legal work of art, which I have not been able to review, was finally released. And it goes contrary to what I thought we had done last session. And so what you have here is an amendment which will state that the risk management fund will pay the cost of mandamus proceedings as opposed to it coming out of the department budget. Now, with the opinion out now, the effect of the opinion is that if you don't adopt and pass this amendment, there will be a fiscal impact of that Attorney General's opinion of, I believe, around $100,000, because that means that rather than the insurance company, i.e. risk management, having to pay, the judicial department out of their budget will have to pay. That's how often judges get sued in this state, by the way, but I don't want to make any commentary on that. So I don't know if it's a coincidence of history, but it all kind of came together, and Mr. Nestle is here, and we're together, and got this amendment. So, but Mr. Nestle suggests to truly, he's an excellent bill drafter, to help me out here in my drafting that Mr. Lundy did down in council the other day. In line six, if you insert in between reasonable costs, it actually should read reasonable defense expenses and cost incurred in defending in the proceeding. So it's just this little bill, although it'll save a judicial department $100,000, and put these costs into the risk management. And important, what's really important about this is that the legislature will be setting the policy in this area, and it'll be clear, and there won't be any debate, and we'll all know, and hopefully we'll all live happily ever after.
Representative Kopeski online, let me just make sure we got what you were saying, this, that the 216A-3 amendments should be on line 6 between the words reasonable and costs. You were inserting defense expenses and?
Yes.
Okay. Could I ask that the committee be, probably should ask Mr. Nessie that, be supplied with a copy of the Attorney General's opinion?
Mr.
this.
Chairman, members of the committee, we'd be glad to provide that as soon as possible. We do have copies available.
Okay, did you wish to comment on this?
Mr. Chair, just so, Mr. Nestle didn't know I was coming here. I didn't know that the opinion was out yesterday. I hope, won't, I mean,